Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby, and joining me is Claire White.
Hello.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. Today we're talking about Luke Cage! Woo! It's the Netflix show, came out on September 29th of this year, 2016. All 13 episodes were dropped via, you know, Netflix style. All at once.
Yeah, it's part of the Marvel Defenders.
Yeah.
Not trilogy. Ongoing series.
Like ongoing building. Yeah, team building.
With Daredevil, Jessica Jones, and then Iron Fist. Yeah.
So Luke Cage is, as like we just mentioned, a Marvel superhero. He's the third one to get his own Netflix show.
Mm-hmm.
So that's exciting. And it seems at the end of this series, I don't want to spoil too much, but it seems like The defenders are imminent.
It will happen.
Yeah.
We also know they're imminent because they've announced the Defenders
series.
This is true.
I just watched an interview with Finn Jones, who plays Iron Fist, and they've officially wrapped shooting for Iron Fist, and that show's coming out in March. March 17th, I believe. So yeah, Marvel is definitely a machine. We talked about this before. If what cogs work in the machine?
Reoccurring theme in the DSRI podcast.
But today we're not talking about Iron Fist. We're talking about Luke Cage, who's, like we said, is a Marvel superhero. I'm going to be talking about his history, his first issue, his origin story, and like he's been on a lot of teams. He's a team player. So I'll talk a little bit about that, and about blaxploitation, which is something that he kind of came out of. And Claire, you'll be telling us about the production and creation of the show, correct?
Correct.
Sweet. So let me get started then on a history of Luke Cage.
Sweet Christmas.
Sweet Christmas.
That's a Luke Cage tagline for anyone who doesn't know.
That's his catchphrase, Sweet Christmas. Luke Cage is a superhero. He first appeared in June 1972 in the issue Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, number one. So like the name says, he was for hire. Like he was using it to make money, but to get revenge, ultimately. I'll get into that when I go into his origin story. He was created by Archie Goodwin, John Romita Sr., and George Tuska.
And were they black?
No.
Okay.
They were not black.
For those who don't know, Luke Cage is black.
Yes, he is. I mean, yeah, if you've seen a trailer, you should know. If you've seen
any haven't seen a trailer.
You're right.
Some people aren't into comics.
His original superhero name was Power Man, and his actual name is Carl Lucas. So his real name isn't even Luke Cage. That also goes into his origin story. And his superpowers, he's super strong, and he's got impenetrable skin. So he was like the bulletproof superhero, is what they call him. And he was not the first black superhero. That title actually belongs to Black Panther, but he was the first black superhero to get his own series.
Oh, wow.
Which is a big deal.
Do you know why?
Yeah, I'll get into that later as well. one of the things that helped push Luke Cage to get his own series. So let me go into his origin story, though. He's from Harlem, and he used to run around Harlem with his best friend, Willis Stryker, and they were kind of like small-time criminals. Luke eventually got out of the criminal gang and wanted to go more legitimate. Stryker stayed in it and kind of rose through the ranks, but they were still friends. Now, they came to a head when they both kind of fell for the same girl.
As they do.
As you do. Reva Connors. So they fell in love with the same girl. Reva ends up going with Willis Stryker. And Willis is involved in all this criminal activity and steps on some big toes, some big like mob toes, and they send people to beat him up. And Reva's there, and Reva sees him getting beaten up and runs and gets Luke, and Luke comes and saves the day. And Reva sees like, oh, I don't want to be with Willis anymore because he's dangerous, and it's just like
bad
a risky life.
Bad boy got to be too bad.
So she ends up falling in love with Luke instead, and Stryker never forgives Luke for this and blames him for losing his girlfriend.
I feel like that's pretty not nice if you date your best friend's
girlfriend your best friend's
after
ex.
She breaks up with like right after she breaks up with him.
That is a little cold.
I wouldn't take that well.
Now let me ask you this. Would you plant drugs in your ex-best friend's apartment and then call the cops to get him sent to prison because he did that?
I don't know emotionally where I'd be. I'm gonna say that.
Because that's what Stryker does to Luke Cage. He plants drugs in his apartment to get back at him and gets him sent to prison. And Stryker also gets Reva killed later by hiding behind her when other gangsters are shooting at him and she takes a bullet and dies.
I can't say I'd be above that either.
So anyway, Luke Cage gets sent to prison, and you know, as it's prison, it's a rough place, and the guards are really mean to him. Specifically, a guard named Billy Bob Rackham. But a new warden comes into town, and the warden's a reformist and is a little bit better. And a doctor also comes with him, Dr. Noah Bernstein. And Dr. Noah Bernstein wants to use Luke to experiment this formula on for cell regeneration. And Luke is like, doesn't want to do it, but then he decides to do it because it'll look better at his parole meetings. He could get out of prison faster. And his whole goal is to get out of prison and get revenge on Stryker. So this doctor, Dr. Noah Bernstein, takes him, he puts him in this electrical chemical bath.
I feel like that's just a bad idea to go into the bath.
Yeah, yeah. They replicate it in the show a little bit in one scene. Yeah. I don't think that's too much of a spoiler where you see like him being lowered into nasty chemicals and it just doesn't seem fun.
Oh, yeah.
But he's sitting there and for whatever reason, Dr. Noah Bernstein wanders off. He's like, all right, let me go get a sandwich or something. I'll leave you in this bath for a little while. And the evil guard, Billy Bob Rackham, who hates Luke, comes in and like, oh, I'm going to get you, Luke. You're stuck in this bath. And he turns the heat up to try and kill him. But instead of killing him, he just gives Luke Cage superpowers.
Should have thought of it in advance.
Yeah, come on, Billy Bob. I mean, I don't know. Your name is Billy Bob. How smart can you be?
Yeah, I read that comic. They make him so evil.
They make him so evil. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So Luke Cage busts out, he escapes prison, and the guards think he's dead, and no one knows of his superpower, and he heads back to Harlem to get revenge on Stryker. Dun-dun-dun. But I want to change gears here and talk a little bit about blaxploitation, which is something that this comic was kind of born out of.
Yeah, because I feel like I know blaxploitation when I see it, but I don't know the actual definition of it.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm going to talk about blaxploitation as a film genre. There's other definitions, and you can look up blaxploitation in other mediums and medias. But as far as a film genre goes, they were made specifically for urban audiences, black people living in the inner cities. But it proved to be a lot more broad, like a lot of people ended up liking these movies. They were normally very violent, and they featured a largely black cast, and they focused often on a black man winning against the system or winning against the man. And they featured a lot of stereotypes that they catch heat for now, where they depicted African Americans as these hyper-violent and hypersexual sort of like caricatures almost. And the oftentimes in blaxploitation movies, you would have like the oversexed, violent private detective, you know, exposing corruption or flip side of that, you would have the black pimp who became the king of the pimps and the king of the drug trade and kind of eventually controlled the neighborhood and the cops couldn't catch him. And it came about at an extremely pivotal time in Hollywood, actually. It was towards the end of the civil rights movement, and actually a lot of the old Hollywood studios in the late 60s and early 70s were going bankrupt. Like, they were having a lot of financial problems, because they were still trying to push, like, musicals and, you know, like, the big, long
Cinderella.
Yeah,
musical.
Like, epics and stuff on a population that just wasn't that interested. And it allowed, so when blaxploitation movies came out that were these, like, hyper-violent, hyper-sexual.
It sounds like an almost James Bond movie.
That's Shaft was like advertised as like cooler than James Bond, you know, like. And what's considered the first blaxploitation movie was this movie called Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, and that's badass with five S's. And it came out in 1971. It was directed by Melvin Van Peebles. And the movie was about a black man who was going to be framed for a murder, and he ends up killing two cops and then escaping, you know, the system. And he's on the lam and he makes it to Mexico. And, you know, it's very violent. It's very sexual. It was made with a really small budget. It was made with a $12,000 budget, but it grossed $10 million.
Wow. That's not, especially in today's dollars.
Yeah. And so the movie studios who saw this were like, oh, man, we got to start making more movies like that because those are making money.
Stop with the musicals. Yeah. Let's make blaxploitation films.
And Sweet Sweetbacks actually received an X rating from the entirely white jury who rated the movies.
Did it deserve it?
I mean, I don't know. It was very sexual and was very violent. I've read stuff that said it didn't really deserve it. Who knows? I mean, I think you'd have to watch it. I've never seen it, so you'd have to watch it and make up your own mind. But the X rating only made it more popular. More people wanted to see it then. So like, oh, it's rated X. It's a big movie.
Hell yeah.
And then I think the blaxploitation movie that everyone knows came out 3 months later, Shaft.
Mm-hmm.
And that really cemented the success of the blaxploitation genre. Shaft grossed $12 million, and it actually saved MGM from bankruptcy.
Were these movies directed by black directors?
Sometimes, but more often than not, no. Once the movie studios were getting the cash, they were just putting, you know, the white directors that they knew already in charge of these films. Like, yeah, make this, make this, make this. We just want the money. So why is this all relevant to Luke Cage?
I'm dying to know, Kyle.
Because Luke Cage was Marvel's attempt at riding the blaxploitation wave.
Oh, so they see these movies making a ton of money, and they're like, we can make a ton of money.
Exactly. Well, the first issue of Luke Cage came out in 1972, which is a year after Shaft and Sweet Sweetback. So,
did they make a ton of money?
I don't know if they made a ton of money, but it was a fairly successful comic.
They didn't make $10 million off of $12,000?
I don't think they made $10 million off of Luke Cage in the 70s. That would be very shocking to learn. But I also, I can't say that they didn't. But so Luke Cage was fairly successful when it started. In the late 70s, though, as the blaxploitation wave started to crash and
burn
and fade, so did Luke Cage comic sales. Like, Luke Cage was going down, and they were thinking about canceling him. But it was in 1978 that Luke Cage was paired up with another hero who rose out of a film niche, that they created a hero for a film niche, which was kung fu films, are also big in the early 70s. So Iron Fist, the hero, was kind of created out of that.
And who's Iron Fist again?
Iron Fist is another Marvel superhero who spent 12 years in another dimension training and learning kung fu, and he comes back and he fights crime. His name's Daniel Rand.
And he's one of the Defenders.
He's one of the Defenders.
Netflix
he's
will
show.
Release a show
yeah.
about him.
Yeah, exactly. But they paired Iron Fist and Luke Cage together because both their comics were dwindling as the success of the film genres they were created out of were also dwindling. And it kind of worked. I mean, their series ran until 1986.
That's a good run.
Yeah, it is. It's a great run. And the series writer, James Owsley, started to really try to downplay Luke Cage's blaxploitation roots. Like, he expanded Luke's vocabulary. He wasn't just using slang all the time. Made him a little...
It's so sad that that's noteworthy. Like, and his vocabulary was expanded.
He wasn't shouting everything all of a sudden, which is nice. Because if you look at the old Luke Cage comics, it always looks like he's, like, yelling every line. But Owsley really tried to play that down a bit, which was good. And he actually, he diminished the use of his silly catchphrase, Sweet Christmas, which I think is a shame.
Everything else is good, but keep the Sweet Christmas.
Sweet Christmas.
Downplay
is
everything.
That's
else.
A great phrase, if I do say so myself.
You should bring it back, like, to real life.
We should. Maybe, you know, the show's been successful and is pretty popular. Maybe Sweet Christmas will start being a thing. But Luke Cage has had a lot of notable comic moments, and he's been a part of a lot of comic teams, and I think it's definitely notable to mention how steady he has been in the comic universe. He had a series in 1992 just titled Cage, which was kind of a reboot. It took place in Chicago, and it ran for 20 issues, and that was written by Mark McLaren. And but he's been involved in a bunch of teams. He was involved in the Avengers, the Secret Avengers, the New Avengers...
Lots of Avengers.
The Defenders. And at one point, he was actually even in the Fantastic Four. When the Thing, who's like the big rock monster, is super strong, lost his powers, they called in Luke Cage.
That was
and he
the
took
closest thing to the Thing.
Yeah.
Luke Cage.
He also actually led the Avengers, I think, which is really important. And like that's something big on your hero resume, is if you at one point were leading
you
the
and
Avengers.
Captain America.
Yeah. That's not a lot of people. An important thing to talk about with Luke Cage too is that, you know, like he started as this hero for hire, and he's not that anymore. But that was like kind of his roots, and he did get grief from other superheroes for that. And money's always kind of been like a thing in Luke Cage comics that like he needs to get paid. Like, he even mentions in a comic that he's not a billionaire playboy like Bruce Wayne. Like,
he says Bruce Wayne's name.
Yeah. He needs to make money, like he needs to survive. And it's also important to talk about how like when he joined the New Avengers, one of his caveats for joining was that we need to focus more on people that I think the Avengers.
And this is a later Luke Cage, right?
Yeah, this is a later Luke Cage. We need to focus on people that I feel like the Avengers and the big superheroes forget about, like the poor and disenfranchised. And in one issue, he even makes them go to Chicago and like do community works in a poor neighborhood. And I think the Netflix show really reflects that with their portrayal of Luke Cage as like being the street level superhero and living in Harlem and not wearing a mask. I mean, Luke Cage isn't his original name, but he's still present and people see him and he's there like for the community.
Right, for the people.
For the people and to help the people. So I mean, we haven't gotten to our opinions yet, but I think that's mad props to the show. I think they did that well.
And he's married to Jessica Jones.
Oh, yes. He's also married. I can't believe I forgot to mention that. He's married to Jessica Jones, and they have a beautiful little biracial baby.
Jessica Jones is white.
Yeah, Jessica Jones is white, and they have a beautiful little biracial baby named Danielle, named after his buddy Daniel, the Iron Fist.
Aw, I didn't know.
Yeah, well, they've been together for a long time, the Luke Cage and Iron Fist relationship.
They're biffles.
And Squirrel Girl is actually the nanny for little Danielle Cage.
Yeah, which you can find out about in our Squirrel Girl episode that we did a couple months ago.
Yeah, we did a Squirrel Girl episode not too long ago. So, yeah. Claire, I think now's a good time to transition into the production of the show.
Well, I'm going to go back to the Jessica Jones show, which came out in November of 2015. It feels like it came out a lot longer than that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
So originally they were going to make an Iron Fist show and then they were going to make a Luke Cage show, but Luke Cage made a cameo in Jessica Jones. He was in about 5-6 episodes.
Yeah, and he was a big deal in it.
Yeah, he was a major part of it. And the fan response was so strong that Marvel actually pushed up the release date for Luke Cage and delayed the Iron Fist production.
Oh, okay. Mike Coulter, who plays beautiful.
Yeah, he plays Luke Cage. He is a very attractive man, which is part of why the
fan reaction was so strong. Get that man his own TV show immediately.
Please. Actually, I know people that I work with, women who they don't like superheroes, but they're watching Luke Cage. I understand. So I read some interviews with the Jessica Jones showrunner, Melissa Rosenberg, and she said when she was writing the Luke Cage character, she said it was very clear for her that she was introducing someone else's lead character. So it was important that when she was writing him, it was a very collaborative experience, that it wasn't her voice. And she actually had some writers in the room who were huge Luke Cage fans, so she relied a lot on them.
Okay, well, that's perfect. I think he came off pretty well in that show.
He did. And she said she only wanted to use him for what she needed him for Jessica, and not much more than that, because she didn't want to really, like, make a universe for him.
She didn't want to, like, write him.
Right. And the Luke Cage showrunner, Chiyohidari Coker, said that when he got the show, he didn't want to eradicate Rosenberg's conception of Luke Cage. He just wanted to expand what she had already started. So it seemed like he was able to take – they didn't work together, but he was able to take her material and go with it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like I said, the show was created by Chiyohidari Coker. He is a very proud comic book nerd. He grew up reading Luke Cage and all sorts of other comics. Before he worked in television and film, he was a music journalist.
Oh, cool.
And that makes a lot of sense if you watch the show. Music is a huge part of it, and I'll talk about that later.
Yeah, a lot of 90s hip-hop stuff in there.
Right. Well, that's because he covered the rap scene in the 90s.
Makes sense.
He wrote for The Source, Rap Pages, and LA Times. He was a big deal. He was interviewing Biggie. He was going to the rappers' houses.
Yeah.
So later he got into producing and writing for TV and film, and he's worked on Southland, Almost Human, he worked on some of the NCIS shows, and he also wrote the screenplay for The Notorious B.I.G., which makes sense. That's like a biography film about the life of Biggie Smalls.
It was called Notorious, if I remember correctly.
Notorious? Okay, I thought it was Notorious B.I.G. I could be wrong. So he got this job for Luke Cage by pitching the series as an examination of Harlem, kind of like The Wire, which is an HBO show that basically examines Baltimore.
Yeah.
And he wanted the show to be unapologetically black. He compared it to Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas.
Yeah.
that is unapologetically about New York Italians.
Yeah, New York Italians up in Arthur Avenue in the Bronx.
Right. And... so he's just taking it a little further south.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm going to talk about the music now because music is such a big part of the show and obviously it's a big part of Coker's life and he put as much of it as he could into the show.
Yeah.
He recruited the producers Adrian Young and Ali Shaheed Mohammed, who is from the musical group A Tribe Called Quest.
Yeah.
To score the show and also to recruit artists to record at this fictional nightclub that's part of the show.
That's like my favorite set in the whole show. And maybe the whole, like, all the Marvel series so far. I love Harlem's Paradise.
Yeah, the club is called Harlem's Paradise. It's so cool. Really cool. And the musical acts were so good.
Yeah, that's the show really shines the music.
Yeah, I wish I could go to that. I wish it existed because we could just go.
Yeah, it'd be amazing.
So these Young and Muhammad helmed the score, and they used a 40-piece orchestra for it.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah, and they said this process sounds really cool. They said that Marvel actually leaned on them to determine what was right for the scene. So they had a ton of creative freedom. But what doesn't sound very fun is that they had 4 days to make all the music for an hour-long episode. And yeah. I'm not a composer in any way, but that seems like a lot of work.
Yeah, that's rough.
And then they would have to go into the studio and record it with the orchestra while writing the next episode score.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that's not a lot of time.
No. And so, like, you're doing that and writing. It just sounds insane. Yeah, they said that they were going insane and just not sleeping.
For 13 episodes.
Yeah. Oof. What kind of timeline does Netflix give them? That's insane.
Yeah, it seems a little ridiculous to me, but...
It's good. It's really good.
The music's great, so props to you guys.
And they...
under pressure.
Yeah. And they, like Coker said, they wanted to make the score unapologetically black. But they didn't want the music to feel cliche. So not a ton of loud shoot 'em up anthems, but they wanted hip hop mixed with jazz and blues at the core.
Yeah.
Kind of to show all aspects of it.
Which they were, I think, very successful at.
Yeah. And I listened to some of the score on Spotify.
Yeah, there's a whole Spotify channel for it.
Yeah, it's super cool. Like, check it out. We'll link to it on the Facebook page. And also, as far as continuing with the music, every episode is named after a Gang Starr song. I didn't know who they were. They're an East Coast hip-hop duo formed in the 80s.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I never heard of them either.
And I read interviews with Coker about why, and he says it's actually not even about the content of the music as much as it's about the title of the songs.
Yeah.
And it was actually an old trick that music journalists used to use back in the day where they would pick a song for a cover line, no matter what the group was, as long as the song kind of referenced what they were talking about.
Yeah.
And he felt that the Gang Starr songs had a presence that could build a cinematic resonance with the story.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So if and I want to link to this too, but there's actually a Spotify list of all the Gang Starr songs
for
the episodes. And so you can listen to those. And I listened to that too. And I really enjoyed it. I don't know a ton about hip hop, especially 90s hip hop.
Oh, was it 80s or 90s?
90s. I think a lot of these songs were written in the 90s, but it's fun to listen to. And he said, like, he's hoping that it will also introduce the audience to new music that maybe they hadn't heard of before.
It definitely did that for me.
Mm-hmm. So getting back to the show, Coker thought it was a huge advantage. Like we talked about before, there are not a whole bunch of like just Luke Cage comics. There's a lot of like Luke Cage and Iron Fist.
Yeah.
So a lot of the Luke Cage villains like Cottonmouth and Black Maria and Diamondback, which are in this show, didn't have a definitive story arc.
So yeah, they're like Monster of the Week almost.
Right. So he felt like he had a ton of leeway while writing the show, which he doesn't have a character that fans are going to freak out about if he doesn't do everything
exactly
like the source material.
Yeah, like, what do you mean MJ's not a redhead? That's BS.
Yeah, like right now.
Like right now. What's going on right now?
And he also, he was talking about the blaxploitation of Luke Cage in the beginning, and he sees blaxploitation as kind of a hip-hop Western thing.
Huh.
And like the saloon is like the nightclub.
Yeah.
That's where all the drama goes down.
Yeah.
And he says like it's an influence of the character. So he wants to wear the influences on the sleeve and at the same time evoke new energy and flavor into it.
Yeah.
So not to shy away completely from the blaxploitation influences.
Yeah.
He hired a diverse set of writers. Apparently, they were mostly African-American, which is a rarity for TV.
Yeah, that is.
I didn't know that, but it didn't surprise me. And he, this is very nerdy, he calls the writer's room the danger room. And for those who don't know, in the X-Men comics, that's where they train and fight each other and refine their powers. The show itself, he wanted to be very sure that they didn't run from controversy. Throughout the show, they explore things like Keep Harlem Black. They use the N-word. Luke Cage wears a hoodie, which is a reference to Trayvon Martin.
Trayvon Martin, yeah. I remember like thinking that a lot, that he's always wearing a hoodie.
And when asked about this, he said that no matter what, it feels like there's something inherently political about a bulletproof black man. And so why shy away from it?
Yeah.
And it was important to him that, and he's an outspoken person, he's an outspoken voice in the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah.
And so it was extremely important to him that the hero be a black hero and not just a hero who happened to be black.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I also just quickly want to mention Mike Coulter because he is Luke Cage and he's wonderful. He broke out in Million Dollar Baby. And he's been in shows like The Good Wife, but apparently he turned down a lot of roles because he felt that they perpetuated black tropes. And actually, he was really hesitant about taking Luke Cage. He hadn't read the comic before, as a child, I should say. Yeah. And then when he did read the comics, he read the early comics, and he wasn't interested in doing anything with the blaxploitation that was in the comics. And they, you know, he was told like, oh, no, we're doing the later comics of Luke Cage where he's more of a family man.
Yeah.
And really fast, I'm going to go into the stats of Luke Cage. So 5 days after Luke Cage came out, it was watched by about 3.52 million adults, they say under the age of 50.
That's just them guessing, though.
I hope so.
Well, it's accounts. Yeah, it's whatever the counts.
The accounts.
That's a lot, though.
It's a lot. It makes it the fifth place most watched original series after, can you guess what the first one is?
On is it Netflix?
On Netflix, specifically.
House of Cards or Orange is the New Black?
No.
What's the first?
Fuller House.
What?
But the next one is Orange is the New Black, then Daredevil season 2, then Stranger Things.
Oh, Stranger Things, of course.
I would have thought Stranger Things would have been the number one, but what do they have against Fuller House?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Fuller House. Whatever.
So it makes it the fifth watched most original series. And the day after the series was released, Netflix kind of shut down for 2 hours. It wasn't working. And Coker was like, oh, did you guys like shut down Netflix, trying to watch Luke Cage? And the article I read was like, no, it couldn't have been that because these other series are more popular. Yeah, so it probably wasn't. But, you know, that did happen.
But that did happen.
As far as how it's doing with critics, it has a 79% Metascore, which it kind of tries to capture the essence of critical opinion. But on Rotten Tomatoes, which also tries to capture that, it's a 96%.
Which is pretty great.
Which is amazing. Yeah. And then it has a user score of 8.3, and that's basically people on Metacritic rating it themselves.
Yeah.
And then an audience average on Rotten Tomatoes of 79%.
So the critics like it more than the audiences.
That's what it seems to be. Okay. What did you think?
I liked the show, but I didn't love it.
I feel the same way. Yeah. I felt like it was in some episodes I was really into because it's like with Daredevil and Jessica Jones, they started slowly for me.
Yeah.
And then I would get more into it and more excited about it the further they went.
Yeah.
Whereas this show, I would be like, oh no, it's hitting it. It's hitting the stride, hitting the stride. And then it would have like three really good episodes. And then the next one would be not as exciting.
Yeah. I had a weird experience with it in that in the early episodes, I was really invested in certain characters and story arcs and less invested in other characters' story arcs. And then as the show progressed more, I got more into the characters that I was previously not invested in and less into the characters that I liked off the bat.
Do you think the show was trying to do that?
No, I don't. I mean, maybe, but it was a little jarring. There's like a midpoint switch in that show for me that was a little jarring.
Right, I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you know, well, we don't want to give too much away because it is full of like twists and turns and some surprises.
Right, which
and
is
stuff,
cool.
Which is cool.
I did enjoy that. I did want to say that as much as I wasn't completely excited by the show, it did leave me really excited to continue on in the Marvel universe.
Yeah.
It didn't turn me off from that at all, And there are a lot of reoccurring characters and a lot of little hints of what's to come that you're like, ooh, I can't wait to see that.
They do, at the very end of the show, they do a good job setting the stage for the Defenders and Iron Fist. And there is a thing, and maybe this is just me, but for me, the Marvel show universe on Netflix is more engaging than the Marvel cinematic universe, even though they're all like technically the same.
Well, the Marvel show universe has more to play with.
Yeah. And I think I'm less burned out on these shows than I am on the movies. I'm still enjoying these movies. Like, I love Captain America Civil War, but...
See, but I enjoy the shows overall probably more than the movies, but some of the movies I've enjoyed way more than any of the shows. Does that make sense? Or I feel like some of the movies are so good and the TV shows don't hit that so good level. Whereas the TV shows are all good and not all of the, and some of the movies are bad. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. What's a Marvel movie that is just so good in your eyes?
Like not great or great?
No, so good.
I really enjoyed Civil War. I loved Chris Pratt's one.
Oh, Guardians of the Galaxy.
Guardians of the Galaxy. And I really enjoyed the first Avengers and the first Iron Man.
Yeah, that's true. It's hard because, I mean, I know I brought this up, but it is still hard to compare the two, like comparing the Marvel shows versus the Marvel movies. Right. I will say, though, that I'm sticking to saying that I feel a little less burned out on the Marvel Netflix shows. And I'm starting to feel a little comic book movie fatigue. Less so Netflix
but
series.
Also you're not watching the DC shows.
That's very true, Claire.
You are watching the DC movies, and we've talked about this before. That could give you some comic book movie fatigue.
Yeah, it definitely
they're a little
could.
Bit rougher around the edges.
Yeah,
and I also want to say again, I didn't love the show, but it was something that I hadn't seen before.
Yeah,
like this is the first black superhero TV show / movie that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And it was cool and it was different and I did enjoy that.
Yeah, no, the subject matter was definitely, I almost wish they got more into the black experience in Harlem.
Yeah, I mean, they got pretty into it.
They did get pretty into it. It's true.
But yeah, there are points they could have delved deeper into.
Yeah. And I know we mentioned the music a bit when you were talking about it in the production, but I think it deserves another mention because the music, every episode almost has its own new theme song that's really good, like really catchy. Each song is.
Yeah, and you were saying that you felt that you had never seen music so well used in the Marvel Universe.
I think the Marvel Universe in general has a distinct lack of music. Like, can you think of any Marvel theme from any Marvel?
Iron Man.
What's the Iron Man theme? Can you hum it?
Oh, no,
that's not. I mean, yeah, I guess that sort of counts. That's Black Sabbath. But there's no, like, you know, Star Wars, you can think of the theme. Jurassic Park, you can think of the theme. But the Captain America has a theme. Can you think of it?
No.
I can't either. You know, each superhero has a little musical motif that runs along with it, but they're so downplayed. And Luke Cage, the music was not front and center, but it was definitely a presence
in
the show.
Yeah, and I enjoyed that. And it did introduce me to a lot of stuff that I didn't know about.
I remember sitting one of the songs, and I forget which episode it's in, but I'm somewhat of a music nerd. The chorus of that song is in 11/4, and I was like, oh, yeah!
I'm going to say I didn't notice that at all.
That's awesome!
Watch it for the 11/4.
If anything, watch it for the 11/4 music. I think it's a cool show, and I think if you're invested in the Marvel Universe, or you just would like to see some diversity on the superhero screen, Luke Cage is definitely something you should check out and watch.
Definitely.
Because it's well done, and it is pushing boundaries. Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com. We would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. You can find the show on Twitter at dsrapodcast. I can be found on Twitter at klex303, that's K-L-E-X-303.
I can be found at Along With Claire, that's C-L-A-I-R-E.
And you can find our producer James at James Foey Jr., that's James Foey, F-O-U-H-E-Y-J-R. You can learn more about our Luke Cage articles for the show where, Claire, you're going to post them.
I'm going to post some music.
Some music, yeah. There's a cool Spotify playlist.
Yeah.
And I have a kind of cool interview with Charles Woods where he talks about blaxploitation that I would like to put up there. And all that will be on our Facebook page if anyone's curious. Our producer, whose head is so big his skin is certainly invulnerable to criticism, is James Foey. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, whose skin is definitely invulnerable to Russian scheming. And we're looking at you, Nikita. We're looking at you. And our music was composed by Pete Rowan, and we're not sure what his skin is invulnerable to, but it is definitely vulnerable to puppy love. He puts up a strong face. The man loves puppies. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.